Irish sporting moment of the decade.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
Amateur boxing stinks from the core right to the top.
Oh, Robbie Brady, you hero!
Olympic champion, I've dreamed of this moment so many times.
It's spinning! It's spinning!
Yeah, you're very welcome to the next hour of OTB's Day of the Decade. In the next hour, we're going to be looking back at the decade of the Premier League and the Champions League, from that Sergio Aguero goal to Fernando Torres scoring at the Nou Camp to send Chelsea into the Champions League final. Who could forget Leicester winning the Premier League title? Steven Gerrard slipping at Anfield and giving Manchester City the league. And we'll be joined by Mark Lawrenson shortly, and we'll also hear from Damien Delaney, who played in that game at Selhurst Park, Crystal Palace, as it's known now, Crystal Palace and Liverpool, that 3-3 draw. I'm joined in studio by Colin Buhig and Enda Cole. A lot to get through, lads. We're going to be racing through this. So I'm thinking, in the Premier League, moments of the decade, you're thinking Sergio Aguero goal is probably the moment.
It's the moment that defines this decade, and probably the moment that showed the real power switch in the Premier League in the last 10 years. I know Ferguson's farewell plays hand in hand with that as well. But so basically the Aguero moment happens and Ferguson's like, I'm going to win the league one more time, and then that's it. And then from then on, it's been Man City and Chelsea and Liverpool in the league, and Manchester United.
And Leicester. And who could forget Leicester, Colin?
Leicester is the moment.
That's the story of the decade, surely.
The story and the moment. I know. We just before we came in here, we talked about the moment and we said, you guys were saying Aguero and I was saying the Gerrard slip for me, Manchester United fan, but I thought that really was the moment of the decade. But I think for it, it's still Leicester for me. I think it's still that moment when Hazard put it into the top corner for Chelsea against Spurs, and that clinched the title for Leicester. I know we're going to talk about it in a while, but for me, that's the moment. But Aguero is just synonymous with United not winning the league. So again,
yeah, and it's negative. The soundbite is Aguero, that goal, and the fact that it's gone down to the last day of the season. City clinched the league on goal difference. Leicester had the league wrapped up. Leicester were in party mood. They had Bocelli singing at
Andrea
the Andrea
Bocelli.
That should be one of the moments.
Last night. I think that was surreal.
I can remember that day as well. And Leicester had been probably on the piss for the week, and they still beat Roberto Martinez as Everton. That was his last game.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Does Gary Neville going on to Match of the Day in his underwear count as part of
Gary Lineker.
Or Gary Lineker,
sorry. Gary Neville.
Gary Lineker going on Match of the Day in his underwear, does that come under the same umbrella as that, or is that a separate?
Well, I think that by the time that happened, the euphoria of Leicester's victory had subsided slightly. So that was, August. So you're like, oh, I forgot he said he was going to do this. Yeah. And then there he is rocking up in his jocks.
Yeah, I said we will go into more detail on the Leicester City win, because, you know, it was incredible. There was moments throughout that season when you thought, actually, it's going to happen. And we probably can pinpoint exactly. Yeah. We'll go into that in more detail in the next over the next hour. Obviously, we're going to talk to Mark Lawrenson, who will give us an insight into maybe how Liverpool as a club felt when Steven Gerrard slipped. And was that the feeling, if we're not going to win it now, we'll never win it? And obviously Rodgers is gone over a year later. Jurgen Klopp takes over. Look what he's done since he's come in. And we'll talk about the Champions League and some of the moments. You think probably one of the best displays you'll ever see, that Barcelona Manchester United 2011 final at Wembley, where Barcelona were unbelievable.
Well, that's it. You think the game's over when, I think it was Samuel Eto'o who opened the scoring, and then Rooney equalises. You're like, oh, maybe United actually do have a chance, and then Barcelona just took over from then on. And when we were preparing for this segment, all I could think about was that was probably the last big moment for that Barcelona team. I know they got to the semi-final and got beaten by Inter a few years later, but As teams go, that's probably one of the greatest teams we're ever going to see grace a field, and that was them at their peak against a great Man United squad. And people often forget that. That was probably one of the strongest United squads they've had.
Paul Scholes was on the bench that night. I was just looking back at the teams. He was on the bench. He went with Fletcher and Giggs in central midfield. Obviously, Park Ji-sung got his usual spot on the left-hand side. Mm. But the thing about that Champions League, the decade, Real Madrid have pretty much dominated. They won 4 in 5 years. do we talk about that Real Madrid team the way we talk about the Barcelona team you're mentioning?
I don't think so. I think it's
very strange.
It's an odd one because they obviously achieved more. But at the same time, when you're talking about total football, Real Madrid didn't play total football.
No.
Real Madrid were efficient. They were like Ronaldo. He epitomised that team because he wasn't doing anything outside of the general play, and then he was getting 3 or 4 goals a game. And that's what that Real Madrid side were. They were efficient.
Yeah, Gareth Bale obviously comes into that as well. He scored some important goals for Real Madrid, scored probably one of the best, if not the best, goal you'd ever seen in a Champions League final. Not the one that went through Karius' hands, but the overhead.
Well, you have that, and then you have the Mario Mandzukic goal, which I thought was going to be one of the best
Bale's
goals. And then Bale's was just phenomenal. Ronaldo also got a goal similar enough to that a few years. Was it the year later?
Yeah, he scored against Juventus.
Yeah. Got the ovation by the Juventus fans, knowing full well what was about to happen a few months later.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Cena. And he's actually in the news today for scoring probably one of the best headers I've ever seen. 2.5 metres in the air he was. So let's just kind of remind people of some of those moments we've been talking about. The Sergio Aguero goal. I can remember this so vividly because at the time I was working in a newsroom and it was coming up towards 5 o'clock. You try and get ahead. Manchester City are 2-1 down to QPR. So I decide, do you know what? I'll start writing my 5 o'clock script because Manchester United have won the league. Then Dzeko scores, thinking, yeah, they still need another goal. It's not going to happen. And then this happened.
And all they've done, that Rooney goal was enough for the 3 points. Manchester City are still alive here. Balotelli.
I remember that goal slightly differently to you.
Yeah.
So I was in a pub watching the game. It was after a football match of my own, so the whole football team was there. And
you're on the minerals,
I was one. There was one or two United fans in total in a packed pub because everyone was here to see the climax of this Premier League season. So it was me and this other lad was a United fan, and the rest were supporting City that day. And the two of us went up, we got a wee pint after United won the game, we were sharing laughs, season's over. And then that happens. The pub erupts, and I just sat there in silence for about 5 minutes trying to process what happened. I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe this happened.
Yeah. But it's the iconic imagery of the Manchester United players at the Stadium of Light after
Phil
the match.
Phil Jones.
They're just Phil Jones with his hands and his hips.
You know, he's never had a poker face.
I actually more vividly remember Wayne Rooney's reaction. More than Phil Jones, but I know what you're talking about, the Phil Jones one. But you know, as a United fan, you think like, it's locked up here, and that City bottled it. But Roberto Mancini that day on the sideline was going nuts, really crazy.
Yeah.
And the players never forgot that reaction of Mancini because it didn't go well the next season. And Mancini, by all accounts, about halfway through the second half, says, "You're ruining this for me." He was shouting. He was going. He basically lost all sort of composure whatsoever that you should have as a top level elite football manager. And he was saying, "You're ruining this for me. You're ruining this for me. Why are you doing this to me?" And the players, by all accounts, did not forget that. So when it came to the next season, it rapidly declined. And as a result, he left. They won it, but they didn't thank Mancini for it.
No, and you think that was a QPR team that weren't mathematically safe going into the game. Joey Barton had been sent off.
He was livid with Joey Barton.
Yeah.
He Such lost. A stupid could, red card.
If you actually look back at that when he gets sent off for the foul on Aguero or the lashing out of Aguero, you can see the red mist in his eyes where something comes over him and he just lashes out. But thinking back to how that City won their last 6 games of the season, including that 1-0 win against United, and the general feeling was once they won that they'd go on and win it. But that United blew that. They lost to Wigan. And then they let that 4-2 lead slip against Everton at Old Trafford.
That's right, Stephen Pienaar was
great that day. Stephen Pienaar, Fellaini was good that day as well.
It was the one that got away, definitely, that title. Yeah. 100%. I remember Antonio Valencia was probably the best player in the league that year, right wing. I think he subsequently got the number 7 jersey after that season, and then he gave it back because he didn't want it and went back to number 25. But he was brilliant. And towards the end, actually, despite those games that you mentioned that United blew it, they were actually brilliant in every other game.
The hammered Villa, but,
and they were brilliant away to Blackburn. I remember one game, and Valencia particularly. And we thought it was all sewn up. And the Sunderland victory at the end of the season was a classic kind of, you need to get a result, and they did, and it was like, that'll be enough to see us through. And then, I think it wasn't Balotelli slid the ball through to Aguero, and everything just kind of went slow, and Aguero took that touch to get it out of his feet. And you said the angle wasn't great. I think Paddy Kenny was in goal for QPR, and had a relatively good angle, but...
Are you blaming Paddy Kenny?
Oh, it's near post, wasn't it? Near post.
Just power, though. That's what Aguero does.
It was just desperation and technique.
And as you said, the following season, City, you kind of think, will they kick on? But it didn't go well. But Ferguson, it was his last season. But he went out that summer and he bought Van Persie. And ultimately, he proves to be the difference. They win the league. That iconic goal, the volley that he scores against Villa. But I can remember the Ferguson news. That was something that nobody really expected. There was a few rumours, right? So famously then on News Talk, Paddy Creran, obviously, you know, all these connections at United, and former colleague of ours, Oisin Langan, said this, put it to him, and he laughed at him. He basically said, that's the biggest load of rubbish I've ever heard. Ferguson is going nowhere. 2 hours later, confirmed, Alex Ferguson is going to retire at the end of the season. Yeah. And they haven't been the same since.
They haven't. And they've had several managerial changes, several managerial styles, and none of them have worked. So you just wonder, what's going to go on? How long is this run going to go on for United? It could be, everyone keeps comparing them to Liverpool in the 90s, and that could well be it. They could well be waiting 20 years for another title.
One year, by the way, to the day Ali got the job.
Oh, yeah.
That he took over.
Like, Manchester United have a history of pretty regular failure outside of Alex Ferguson and Matt Busby.
Yeah.
If you actually look in the history of United, and this is what's going to happen. I remember when David Moyes got announced, and there was a bit of positivity, there was a bit of optimism, like, oh, Moyes done a good job at everything.
Scottish manager.
Good job.
This could work.
Fergie knows what he's doing, he's handpicking him. Yeah. And I remember Fergie's speech after that Swansea game at Old Trafford, in his last game at Old Trafford. And I remember he said to the fans, your job now is, that's at that exact point as well, your job now is to support our new manager. And it just couldn't have gone more wrong, really.
We can hear that iconic speech you're talking about, Colin.
When we had bad times here, the club stood by me. All my staff stood by me. The players stood by me. Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
Yeah, and David Moyes was gone by April. His 6-year contract.
Last game at Goodison Park as well. But
Grim Reaper. Do you remember the Grim Reaper was there?
Oh yeah,
guy
that's
in the
right,
crowd
yeah.
as the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Grim Reaper was there a long time before that match.
I think the 3-0 defeat to Liverpool really hurt as well.
Well, and then they got easily beaten the Manchester Derby, and they said, we aspire to be a team like Man City, which he was absolutely right in saying, but you can't say that in public. Yeah. Like, as a Manchester
he said
United
a lot
manager.
Of things wrong.
Sometimes
you can feel these things, but you just can't say them.
Exactly, that's it. You internalise that. So if you compartmentalise it, or you say it to your staff, but you don't say it in public.
Definitely, especially in the world of social media, whatever you say will go viral. And Ferguson actually said when he was leaving, he said, I'm leaving behind a squad that bodes well for continued success.
But he had to say that. He knew, well, I mean, one of Fergie's, I think one of his biggest failures was that he didn't really replenish that squad. I mean, that squad, 2012-13, the last one to win it, was one of the worst squads to win the Premier League. Not because of the actual quality of the players, but because a lot of them were ageing. A lot of them. And it was basically the Rooney and Van Persie show for a lot of that season. And even then, Rooney had a bit of a funny out with Fergie and dropped back into midfield. And Moyes had a lot of work to do when he came in. He signed Juan Mata. He overpaid for Fellaini. He bottled signing Herrera. And I think it was so inevitable that it was going to happen. But I never expected it to happen within the one season. Yeah. And his first game, he won the Community Shield.
Yeah.
And then they beat Swansea 4-1 away.
So
it was a great start.
Yeah, things were all good. Yeah, so that was the 2013-14 season. And that season will be remembered. Okay, we know Manchester City won the league, but it's always going to be remembered for the Steven Gerrard slip against Chelsea. You know, Liverpool are on a run of 11 wins in a row. Looks like they're going to do this. They're going to get the monkey off the back, win their first Premier League title, first league title since 1990. Then Steven Gerrard slips and Demba Ba puts the ball on the net. There's obviously another goal, and Liverpool then draw with Crystal Palace. I know you spoke to Damien Delaney about that game. Yeah. We'll hear from that in a moment. But we've got Mark Lawrenson on the line. Mark Lawrenson, we're looking back at the moments of the decade. You think back to that moment at Anfield and Jose Mourinho rocks into town, and some people just felt Liverpool were going to see this out. But I remember a lot of Liverpool fans thought if there's one manager you don't want coming to Anfield to ruin the party, it was Jose Mourinho.
Yeah, I'm absolutely right. And I think also, didn't he play a slightly weakened team? So you can imagine the anticipation before the game from Liverpool supporters, or the majority of them, thinking, well, you know, it's not the best Chelsea team that they've ever faced. So you can imagine that Liverpool were going to turn them over. But I do think, and I just listened to you there, that the bigger thing for me as well would have been the Palace game, where they were 3-0 up, were they not?
Yeah.
And it was almost like, well, let's go for goal difference. Let's go and score more goals. And then obviously, you know, 3-1, 3-2, etc. And even then, I think it was probably Brendan Rodgers' biggest mistake was that they just didn't shut up shop and go, you know what, we've won. Let's make sure we get the 3 points. But yeah, there were two very, very strange games, certainly at that crucial part of the season.
Yeah, I think, thinking back to that Crystal Palace game, Mark, obviously, if they'd won that game, you know, they still probably would have lost out on goal difference to Manchester City. So I don't think they were ever going to catch the goal difference, but I suppose...
No, possibly not. But you know, just a little aside to that story, I spoke to Tony Pulis about it a couple of years later, and he came in at half-time in that game, 3-0 down, obviously manager of Palace, and he said to his two centre-backs, he said, you know what, you two... He said, I'm ripping your contracts up at the end of the season. You're absolutely hopeless. And his assistant, David Kemp, actually said, Gaffer, do you know what? I think we can come back in this game. And apparently it was like, you know, good cop, bad cop. And of course, as we know, in the end, we got back to 3-3. But no, yeah, I'm with you. But it was just, you know, make sure you win the game, because then obviously you don't know what's going to happen in terms of the last game, do you?
Yeah, just let's take it back to the day at Anfield, Liverpool-Chelsea. And, you know, you see the Chelsea team sheet. And I remember actually one player in particular, Kallas, the centre half.
Yes.
Young lad had never played for them before. And you can imagine Luis Suarez is probably thinking, I'm going to have a hat full against these guys. But typical Mourinho, they sat in. But there was just so much tension. And it's the slip, but it's the timing of the goal. It's right on half time as well. Deflates the whole stadium.
Well, not only that, but probably more importantly, you know, so Chelsea go in and, you know, the manager's going, absolutely brilliant, boys, the plan is working. You know, people like Kallas, obviously, that would really seriously have settled them, etc. And he just went, you know, stay where we are, we're going to win this game. And as you can imagine, as any kind of Mourinho half-time team talk when his team are leading would be. So, yeah, well, that's just, you know, one of the anomalies of football, isn't it? And you're right about Luis Suarez. He probably thought, this kid, I'm going to absolutely tear him apart and score a hat-trick. But as we know, it doesn't always work out that way.
One of my memories of that game as well is a corner from Iago Aspas where he made an absolute pig's ear of it.
Yeah. And
it was right at the end. Because even a draw wouldn't have been the worst result. It would have, you know, it still would have gone right down to the wire, but the fact that they couldn't get the equaliser, and it definitely affected Steven Gerrard as well, Mark, because he was taking shots from everywhere. We know he can score from all sorts of angles, and but you know, he probably felt sole responsibility for it.
Well, he did, because you know he was and still very much probably is alongside Sir Kenny, that you know Mr. Liverpool. So, and he would already, he would be thinking in his head, thinking, oh my goodness, this is going to be all about me, not about the fact that, you know, we didn't play particularly well, etc. So he knew. And there was such already, there's a massive weight on his shoulders because, you know, as everybody knows, he really drove Liverpool on that season. And I'm sure everybody even now still reminds him of it, certainly. But look, it is what it is. And You know, sometimes when you look at games after you played them and you see what the hell. I mean, A, you know, how on earth did we win it? Or B, how on earth did we fail to win it? And how on earth did we get beat? So it's something that'll live with him. But hey, it didn't suddenly make him a bad player, did it? Because he'd been brilliant that season for Liverpool.
Yeah, and I always think back to the, there was a couple of games around not too far away from this time of the year where Liverpool went away to City and away to Chelsea. Two games they went ahead in, but they lost. And really where they actually lost the league title that season, Mark, was their defence and their goalkeeper weren't good enough.
Yeah. No, they weren't. So, I mean, there's two ways of looking at it, and you're absolutely totally right. So they weren't good enough. But then if you think about that, you know, They had a not good enough defence, including the goalkeeper, and yet they came so close to winning it. Tells you something about the attacking talent that they had, and we know all about it. You mentioned Luis Suarez. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, if Luis Suarez had stayed for another couple of years, he would have been up there with Sir Kenny Dalglish, insofar as every goal he scored that season was just a worldie. I mean, every week you watch him play and you go, he can't score as good a goal as he scored last week and stuff like that. And he did. And he was just sensational. But it only kind of mirrored the fact that, you know, as you rightly say, they had a very much a weakness, certainly in the centre of defence. And you say the goalkeeper wasn't good enough.
Yeah, problems that they'd continue to have for a long time. And obviously Brendan Rodgers then parted ways in 2015. Jurgen Klopp comes in October. He's still there. We know he's just signed the new contract. What was your feeling when Klopp took over? Obviously, what he had done with Dortmund, did you think, yeah, this is the man to turn it around? I can remember talking to you weekly on Premier League Live, and there was so many games where you questioned, what is he doing? Like, how does he not see that he needs a centre-half? How does he not see that he needs a goalkeeper?
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I think also, I remember I don't even know if it was his first game. I can't remember. Chelsea away. Chelsea again. And we're looking at the team sheet and we're thinking, who's playing up front? You know, because we thought, what on earth? And that's when he played with the first kind of false number nine. And we're going, really? And of course, they won that day. Did it? I think they might have won 3-1,
yeah. I can remember Coutinho scored. His first game, it's funny. Actually, if you look at his first game, which was away to Spurs, the team sheet does the rounds every so often just to remind Liverpool fans what it was like when he took over.
Yeah, but I think I'd been to Dortmund on a couple of occasions when he was a manager, and you know everybody knows about the wall, obviously the area behind the goal, etc. But there was something about him, and I'd seen him on TV, I'd seen him, and he could speak decent English there insofar as stuff he was talking about, the way his teams play, etc. And you just kind of thought, wow, he's got it. And it's always easy to be clever after the event, but you just kind of knew there was something about him, the way he spoke. He was very kind of striking, big guy, and he, you know, great big eyes and looked at you and stuff, and you kind of go, yeah. And I think very shortly after he'd been appointed, there was an awful lot of supporters that you see were obviously supporters of other teams. And they kind of went, wow, this fella looks like he's got it. I wish we had him. And I think that really, he just really strengthened that verdict, you know, in everything he's done so far. And he gets the whole thing. He gets the history. He gets the supporters. He even gets the old boys he used to play, etc. And he just gets the whole thing. And one thing I will say about him is that he has probably more than any other manager, including Guardiola, he's improved every single player that he's ever, A, inherited or B, signed. And that's a sign for me of a good coach, manager, call them what you will.
Yeah, and up until June, one thing that was getting thrown at him was his record in finals. I know you were in Kiev that infamous night where there was a sense when Mo Salah came off injured that it was going to be tough for Liverpool. And then you watched Loris Karius just have a meltdown. It's quite uncomfortable watching it, you know, to see somebody at the elite level have such a poor game.
Yeah, well, he was never good enough anyway, was he? And I think they realised that quite quickly, even before that game. But I think in many ways, the Karius meltdown really helped Klopp and the football club, because the American owners were there, and I don't think it was kind of planned to go and spend absolute zillions on a new goalkeeper. But apparently, I'm told that after the match, you know, they had a chat with Klopp, and it was all, you know, what do you need? And he went, well, you know, obviously the goalkeeper's not good enough. We need to replace him. And they just said, go on then, on you go. Go and get yourself a goalkeeper. So out of the kind of the bad news night that they had, obviously in terms of the actual game, it was only good news because, you know, went away and signed Alisson. And as everybody knows, he's done fabulous for them alongside, obviously, Van Dijk.
Yeah, he had a good game in Qatar last night. Any other highlights of the decade before we let you go? I can always remember the season Leicester won. I used to ask you every week, can they win it, Mark? Can they win it? And eventually you gave me the soundbite I wanted. You said, yes, they can do it.
A week before, maybe.
I know.
Well, that was just a great story. And obviously we've seen a little bit with them this season as well. But I think for me that the biggest highlight of the decade, that kind of one-off moment, was the Aguero goal against Queen's Park Rangers. I think that, you know, we've all known for a while that the Premier League is certainly now a global competition watched all the way across the world. And I just think that day, that goal, how late it was scored and in the way in which it was scored as well, probably did more for the Premier League than you can probably admit that most of the other great moments in the Premier League that we've previously seen and have seen since.
Okay, lovely stuff, Mark. Before we let you go, I know obviously we'd love to do this in 10 years' time. We'd be talking about a decade of Preston in the Premier League.
And,
we can be
dream on.
Looking at those highlights. Have a great Christmas and enjoy all the football.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thanks very much. That's Mark Lawrenson, former European Cup winner with Liverpool. Now, one game you would have heard referenced when I was talking to Mark was the 3-3 draw between Crystal Palace and Liverpool, known as Cristanbul. Liverpool 3-0 up, and then they concede 3 goals, bit of a meltdown, and they don't win the league. And Damien Delaney, the former Republic of Ireland international, was one of those centre-halves that Mark Lawrenson referenced, that Tony Pulis was talking about getting his contract ripped up. Well, Damien Delaney was good enough to take out some time and speak to Colin Buhig about that game and some of his memories of playing for Crystal Palace during this decade.
Now, one of the biggest moments in the Premier League history of the last decade was May 5th, 2014 at Selhurst Park when Crystal Palace took on Liverpool. I think we all know what happened there. Liverpool going 3-0 up, and then Palace had the amazing comeback which scuppered Liverpool's title bid for that season. We actually have a man joining us today who played in that game, Damien Delaney. Damien, how are you?
Glad you.
Not too bad now. Damien, you actually scored in that game as well. The first goal back in the Grey comeback. Tell me, how much of a difference did the Glenn Johnson deflection actually make to that goal? Or was it going in anyway?
It was going in, but I always say it was going in the other corner. It was just a slight deflection, but it was a great night, and I'm delighted just to be a part of a game that everybody remembers and is part of kind of folklore for Crystal Palace fans at this stage. So it's something that will live with me for the rest of my days.
And like, how, just for people who don't even remember that well, how good was that Liverpool side, certainly in comparison to this side, when you were playing them that night? Did you realise these lads really mean business and they could go and win the league, or what was the feeling for you that night?
Yeah, I mean, look, there was a fantastic Liverpool team. They were obviously all out attack. They weren't quite as defensively good as the current team. But, you know, you had Raheem Sterling playing. You had, Gerrard. Sturridge was top of his form there. Suarez, obviously, as well. And Coutinho. So when you think about that front five, they're absolutely exceptional. Just unfortunate that they didn't have any legs going the other way. And they shipped an awful lot of goals. I mean, you remember that Flanagan was playing at left back that time, and Glenn Johnson at right back, so both very, very attacking full backs. So they scored an awful lot of goals, and they were a very, very good attacking team. But the current Liverpool team is much more balanced, has much more defensive capabilities.
Damien, when it comes to these kind of games, usually it's half-time, you're 3-0 down, and people credit the manager with giving a rousing team talk that brings the comeback. But you were actually only 1-0 down at half-time, and two of the goals came in the second half. So was it a kind of collective mindset that you would just, you know, go out and attack these players, you've seen in previous games that this Liverpool side were capable of conceding late goals and conceding multiple goals in a game. So what was the turning point in that game for you?
It was strange for us because I think the week before we won at Cardiff to secure our Premier League status. So we all had a very good week in training, enjoyed ourselves, and perhaps took a foot off the gas a little bit, which I'm sure the manager definitely reminded of us at half time. He was extremely upset because I know we really wanted it done, but we didn't play well and we weren't playing well at the time, and we definitely weren't like our usual selves. We were just kind of maybe enjoying our moment a bit too much. But he had a goal at half time, and I don't think the second half was much better. We conceded another two goals and we were 3-0 down. And the game just seemed to be kind of, you know, gone from us. But yeah, typical of the team that we had, that we never ever really threw the towel in. You know, even when we were losing 1-2, 3-0, we still had a goal and we still, you know, pressed like we should have done and attacked like we should have done. But I just think once the goal went in, I don't know, the whole of Sellers just seemed to come alive really, and everyone just, you know, and then the other two went in, and you know, I just wish the game was a couple of minutes longer because we could have went on to win it.
Yeah, and the Liverpool players looked absolutely heartbroken after the game, but just after your goal and maybe after Dwight Gayle's first goal, could you feel the momentum building towards your side? And even could you feel that those Liverpool players were actually starting to feel the pressure here and they knew what was on the line?
Yeah, because I think they had their mindset when they went 3-0 up. I think I remember, you know, the Liverpool fans were chanting something like, "We want 8 or something like that, because I think the goal difference, they were looking to get level on goal difference with Man City. So they were chanting that. So then obviously when we equalised, I think they realised they weren't going to get 8. So their mentality was almost like, oh my God, we've won the game, but we've not closed the goal difference. And then I think they just switched off a little bit. And even when it went to 3-2, you know, Brendan Rodgers had, there was Daniel Agger on the bench, I think it was, and he didn't want to bring him on. And he just kept bringing on attacking players, even at 3-1, 3-2. So they just kept wanting to win the game by as many goals as they could. And we were lucky enough to catch him.
Damien, in terms of the last decade as a whole for yourself, would you say that, or is it fair to say that the 2016 FA Cup final was your own highlight, personally?
Not really. No, I think the playoff final really would be for me in 2013, I think it was. 2012 or 2013. I think that was definitely the highlight, because that's just such a career-changing moment. And I know everyone says that, you know, if you could get promoted anyway via the playoffs is the best way. And obviously getting promoted from the Championship into the Premier League at 30 or 31 years of age, I think it was at the time, was something special for me, and it changed my life and it changed the whole course of Crystal Palace Football Club, you know. I think Wilfred Zaha won a penalty for us in the second half of extra time, and Kevin Phillips scored it. So, you know, you're a matter of minutes away from either another 50 games in the Championship or a career-changing moment and getting to go in the Premier League. So that would definitely be the highlight for me.
And one of the players that scored two of the goals in that Liverpool game, Dwight Gayle, he was always a player that I kind of, he confused me when I went up to the Premier League. He just didn't seem to push on. And then every time we went down to the Championship, he would be on fire and scoring 20-odd goals a season. How good was he? Was he capable of maybe pushing on to something better in the Premier League?
Yeah, see, Dwight Gayle's an interesting one. He's probably the best finisher that I've seen, left foot, right foot. He is, like, you watch him in training, his finishing is, I think, second to none, really, for what I've seen anyway. But when you go into Premier League, Gailey's quite short. He's a goal scorer. You know, there's not much else to Gailey's game, and I don't mean that disrespectful, you know, to him. He's a finisher. You know, he just needs to stay in the box and put the ball in the back of the net. Unfortunately, in the Premier League, when you're a new team that come up, you need more than that. You need a number 9 who's going to hold the ball up, win headers, win free kicks, you know, chase channel balls. And Gailey, obviously, that's not his strength. Whereas when he goes into the Championship with the Newcastle, who are, you know, the strongest team by far in the Championship, they can play him up front. So I think what ends up happening with Gailey, he needs to play up front with someone, you know. And it's very hard to play two up front these days, because then you can only play two in midfield and you leave yourself one short. So most managers want to have three in midfield because you have to win the midfield battle, which means you're going to have one up front. So I think that's what Gailey suffered from every time he's gone in the Premier League. But I still think he would have, you know, I was very disappointed when Crystal Palace sold him, because he was definitely someone that, you know, he was our top scorer 3 years in a row. And I think he only started 7 or 8 games, but he came off the bench and scored a handful of, like, 12, 13 goals in the Premier League. because he was just a finisher. So if you were chasing the game and you're losing 1-0 or drawing 1-1 and you wanted to win the game and you wanted to go 3 up front or 2 up front and go for it, he was the ideal guy to bring on. But, you know, I think Gailey wanted to play more regularly. He wasn't happy just coming off the bench and stuff, so he moved on.
Yeah, and another one of those strikers that you played with sort of fits the bill to what you were describing, someone who can hold up the ball, was Christian Benteke, and he actually went to Liverpool after Crystal Palace and then went back to Crystal Palace. What was he like as a player? Was he just a target man, or did he have more to his game?
Yeah, he's all right, Christian. That's an opinion. He's okay, man. He needs crosses, really, if I'm being honest with you. That's all Christian can live off, like, you know. But I don't really have an opinion on him, to be honest with you.
Dame, you might have an opinion on who is the best centre-half of the last decade that either you've played with or played against, someone that really stuck out in your mind that you admired a lot. Is there anyone that...
It would have to be... We played against John Terry, who was obviously fantastic in the noughties, and the first part of the last decade, he was good, and I know he was kind of tailing off just as I got to play against him. But just to be on the same pitch as him, I thought he was, you know, the best player and the best centre-back in the Premier League in the last 10 years, in the 10 years previous, sorry. But, you know, in the decade that I played, you'd have to look at Vincent Kompany. I mean, he was something else for Manchester City when he was in his prime. He was so, when he was fit, you know, before all his injuries, he was just a colossal man, big, strong guy, 6'4", 6'5", quick, good on the ball, aggressive, scored goals, could do everything. So for me, I would say in the last decade, Vincent Kompany.
Was there any high-profile player in the Premier League that you played against that was a surprising letdown, that you weren't actually that impressed with him at all and he came with a very big billing?
I remember we played against Chelsea 1 year. I think it was the year they won the league under Mourinho. A guy called Juan Cuadrado, who they signed from big money. He was a right winger, and I think he went back to Juventus, and he was absolutely, he's been fantastic at Juventus and other places. But I remember playing against him, and he was just so disappointing, you know, because it was early on the season, I think, as well. And I was just looking forward to seeing him play because I'd watch him in Italy and in international games as well. And I know he had a really disappointing that year for Chelsea. And then he went back to Juve and absolutely tore it up. So maybe the Premier League wasn't, maybe London wasn't for him. So he just never really settled. But I remember being disappointed after the game, after seeing him.
And since you played in this decade, most of your career in the Premier League, you've come up against systems, different styles of play, Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp, Antonio Conte, Jose Mourinho, etc. Whose team was the hardest to play against?
I used to, obviously all the names you mentioned there were very, very good managers and obviously have certain styles, but a manager who I used to hate playing against was Roberto Martinez when he was at Swansea and at Everton. He was total football. I mean, he was the one that put the whole Swansea blueprint in place, you know, and every manager that came in after him just kind of built on what he did. And when he went to Everton as well, it was the same. It was like possession-based football. It was ultimate possession-based football. And, you know, he used to play with like five in central midfield and one up front and just really confusing things would happen. And they were very, very clever and they had very, very good patterns of play and stuff. So, Roberto Martinez used to always not want to play in those games because you knew that something different was coming at you.
Would you not have felt against a Roberto Martinez team that you always had a chance of scoring, though?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I agree with you, like, what I'm saying, but you knew that, like, you know, if you were playing against Martinez, if you were going to have 25% possession and you were just going to be chasing the ball all the time. But you kind of got through that because you knew that, you know, you had an opportunity to score because you knew that when they lost the ball, sometimes you could. And we had some good results against Martinez's teams, but I just going into the games, you just knew what you were going to do is chasing the ball because they were the ultimate possession-based team.
And finally, Damien, how would you sum up Irish football in the last decade?
Would I sum it up? That's an interesting one. Mediocre, disappointing, that we haven't kicked on. You know, when Trapattoni left in 20, 2014, am I right in saying that he left in Euro 2013, that we didn't kick on and just go off in another direction. And, you know, we could be 6 years down the road now and we could be a much better place than what we were. That's the on-field stuff, but the off-field stuff obviously hasn't been great either.
All right, thanks a million for joining us, Damien. Cheers.
No worries, lads. Thanks, boys.
Yeah, that's Damien Delaney chatting to Enda and Colm about life in the Premier League, going up against Juan Cuadrado.
I didn't read him.
Christian Benteke. Christian needs crosses. Christians like crosses.
They do.
They do.
Benteke really needs one.
He does. And if you put in the right ones, like Jordan Ibe did at Old Trafford all those years ago, he can smash in an overhead.
It could be, I'm not sure about this, but it could be at least 7 years since Christian Benteke has actually scored a goal.
I think I heard a stat when I was watching the Palace game the other day that he hasn't scored at Selhurst Park in the league for 2 years.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Like he just cannot get the ball in the net.
And I'd say that was probably a penalty. Damien Delaney, of course, used to play for Leicester. Leicester winning the league is the story of the decade. Leicester winning the Premier League. By the way, if people are tuning in and going, why aren't you talking about Irish football? There's a whole hour between 5 and 6. Nathan Murphy and Johnny Ward are going to talk about Irish football, the international team, League of Ireland. So there's just so much to get through that we tried to split it up. So we're talking Premier League, Champions League. So Leicester City in the Premier League. Claudio Ranieri gets the job. You're thinking, well, that's going to go horribly wrong. He's just got fired as the Greek manager.
Yeah, he was out of work. He was on a holiday in Italy. And his agent, Steve Kuttner, was the mastermind behind this. So Steve Kuttner wanted to get Ranieri back into English football. Nigel Pearson had just been sacked quite controversially by Leicester.
Yeah, because they won 7 of the last 9.
And the players loved Pearson.
Yeah.
Yeah, 7 of the last 9 games to save them. Kuttner sent in Ranieri's CV.
I'd love to see it.
You know, highlighted all the plus points. That he did well with Valencia, and he did okay at Chelsea, and he said, "Look, all I want is an interview. Just give my client an interview. Give Ranieri an interview," and they granted him the interview, and he wowed them in the interview because of his charm and his knowledge about football. So they gave him the job. But that summer, Leicester were 5,000 to 1 to win the Premier League, and there was a 39-year-old local electrician, who put a fiver on it. Just for the crack, but if I run a Leicester fan, 25 grand out.
How do you even think about that?
But like 2016 was such a mad year anyway, because you had those rake of celebrity deaths, all those Muhammad Ali, Arnold Palmer, David Bowie, Alan Rickman. It was such a mad year.
Are then they all tied into Ramsey scoring? Ramsey scoring goals?
You had Trump elected, you had Brexit. And he had Leicester City winning the Premier League by 10 clear points.
Yeah.
Leicester City, whose previous best position was runner-up in 1929. Leicester City, who had been relegated and promoted a combined 22 times. Leicester City, who the year before had the great escape. And Leicester City, who had absolutely no star players.
Yeah.
And they ran home to the league with a simple 4-4-1-1 setup.
Team 33 won the Emerald that year as well, ahead of Off the Ball. Another underdog story.
So It was the year of the underdog.
It was amazing.
But I remember like every game thinking, like, oh, it's going to end now. It's going to end now. And like Arsenal did a double over them that year. Arsenal finished second.
Arsenal beat them.
They hammered them 5-2.
At the King Power, yeah. early in the season. There was a stage in the season where they couldn't keep clean sheets. And Ranieri said, if you keep a clean sheet, I'll bring you all out for pizza.
That's right.
I think it was against Crystal Palace at home. They kept their clean sheet and they got to... The twist was they actually had to make the pizzas themselves.
Yeah.
It was a great story, though, because if you look at some of the players that was brought into the side, you had Huth, who had a good career at Chelsea, but never really... He wasn't going to be a title-winning centre-half. Kante came in from League 2, or the second division in League 1 in France. And then you had the likes of Mahrez, Jamie Vardy, who came off through the English system, played all four English leagues. You didn't have players that you didn't really know of.
The season before, I saw Mahrez play at Anfield, a game where Liverpool were 2-up, and actually Vardy scored. David Nugent scored in that game as well. But Mahrez, it was the first time I'd ever seen him. I was like, who is this guy? He's unbelievable. He was playing right wing, and he was just a bag of tricks.
But there was huge doubts over Mahrez. They signed him in 2014 for $450,000, and the feeling about him was he's very technically gifted and proficient, but he's physically very limited and very light. But Ranieri came in, and I think in July, by the time he came in, Leicester had actually done a good bit of business that summer after sacking Pearson, and it's all down to Steve Walsh, head of recruitment, who had this amazing eye for talent. So he made the Robert Huth signing permanent from Stoke. He signed Christian Fuchs from Schalke, signed Shinji Okazaki from Mainz, and then the big one, N'Golo Kante. So he was saying all summer long to Ranieri, Kante, 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 you have to sign this guy. He's amazing. He's unbelievable. And Ranieri, who is a football obsessive and knows most things about the game, had never really heard of Kante. And in fact, loads of top clubs hadn't heard of Kante. But Walsh said, you have to get this guy. His statistics, the way he covers the ground, he's misleading in terms of his physique. He's amazing. I mean, we all know it now. But at the time, no one did. And Walsh said, look, whatever about the other signings that I've got for you, this team that I've helped build for you, you have to sign Kante. And they did for, I think, about £7 million. And actually, at the start, Kante wasn't starting for Leicester. And whenever he did play, he was put out the left wing, because Ranieri had this nagging feeling that physically he couldn't do it, until eventually he brought him into the middle. And then the rest is history.
Yeah, him and Drinkwater.
And also Danny Drinkwater, who, at the tail end of the previous season, when Leicester went on that run and won 7 out of their last 9 games, Drinkwater wasn't playing.
Yeah. And Kante's biggest achievement was getting Danny Drinkwater an England cap.
Well, Danny Drinkwater was
maybe winning the Player of the Year, but I know what you mean.
Danny Drinkwater was
They go
brilliant.
Hand in hand.
He was excellent that season, and he should have made that England squad for Euro 2016, and he was dropped at the last minute.
Yeah.
He was brilliant. He actually scored in their last game of the season away to Chelsea when they had already won the league, and Ranieri went back to the old stamping ground 11 years after being acrimoniously sacked for, you know, basically, look what I've done now.
But also, he actually played a part in Mourinho getting sacked that season.
Yeah, it was the mid-December, and this time of the year, Mahrez had that amazing goal where he dummied and put into the far corner, and after the game, Mourinho accused his players of betraying him.
Yeah.
And he was gone. So and that's the thing about that season, that's why there's so many moments of that season. It's not just that Leicester won the league, but they had great moments. They had that game where it was the end of Mourinho at Chelsea, and you could argue that Mourinho's never really recovered from that. Then you had Jamie Vardy breaking the Premier League consecutive scoring record with 11 games in a row and breaking that against Manchester United.
Yeah,
breaking
that all in a day off Red Bull and Skittles as well.
But the goal against Liverpool. Remember that?
Oh, the volley. Yeah, when it's
when you started thinking, do you know what? Amazing. This is happening.
I don't think so. I thought it was still too early then. And I remember when I stood up and thought, Jesus, maybe, was the Man City performance at the Etihad when they won 3-1, when Robert Huth scored twice. And Leicester tweeted saying, just in case, if you're just tuning in now, Leicester are 3-0 up and Robert Huth is on a hat-trick. Yes, this is happening.
I can remember actually before that, it was the Arsenal game. I know you said Arsenal.
Saying that to me yesterday,
Arsenal did the double over them. And I can remember because Arsenal played Leicester, it was Valentine's Day, and I was thinking, right, this is an early game, so how do we do this now? Valentine's Day, is it going to be spent watching football? So I went and I watched it, and even though Leicester lost, they put in such a good performance. Danny Simpson got sent off in that game, and Welbeck scored with pretty much the last play of the game. I remember thinking, yeah, they're good enough to do this.
But that's where Ranieri came into his own, because they were devastated after that result, obviously, because they lost the last minute, and Arsenal were actually their biggest challengers that year, because that was a year when a lot of the big boys really didn't show up at all. Yeah, the Gary Breen was on with us last week referring to that moment. Ranieri, with his masterstroke of man management then, and it was only a masterstroke because of what subsequently happened, but his reaction to that defeat was to give all of his squad the week off. And I mean no training or anything, just go off and enjoy yourselves, because he knew the pressure was getting to them. Because his thing throughout that whole season was, oh, as long as we get the 40 points, that's a successful season for Leicester City. And he was correct to say that, but he knew internally, upon reflection, that he knew there was something special happening here. And that's why they were so gutted after the Arsenal game. So he gave him that break. But Ranieri had a lot to battle with at the start, because those players loved Nigel Pearson. They loved him. And because Pearson gave them a lot of power, and he used to go to the senior players to court their opinion on a lot of things. So when Ranieri came in, he found that there was a bit of back and forth about certain things that he was trying to implement. Like, they had a sacrosanct six-a-side game every Friday before the weekend, and the players refused to drop that. So Ranieri had to go along with it. But the one thing that Ranieri did change was the tactics, because at the end of the previous season, Pearson favoured a back three, And Ranieri said, no, we're going to a back four.
Yeah.
Players were sceptical. And he said, no, we're going to a back four. And Morgan and Huth had that amazing partnership at the back. And he had Fuchs and Simpson at the fullbacks. And it was just such a... It was such a tidy team, and it almost picked itself. I think 7 of the 11 players started over 30 league games, and the only players that were in and out were Okazaki and Albright and Damari Gray, who was signed from Birmingham that summer.
He
played
in,
a bit.
He came in January.
Leandro Ojoa, who was the reserve striker behind Vardy, was very important.
He scored a big goal against Norwich.
Huge against Norwich, in
injury time.
But Okazaki had that bicycle kick against Newcastle. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. They had all these moments.
Yeah. We've run out of time. We haven't even got into Pep Guardiola and how he revolutionised the Premier League towards the end of the decade. Obviously, he came in, signed Claudio Bravo, didn't work out.
Spent 100 million on two wing-backs and we all laughed at him.
Everyone thought, oh, this Pep Guardiola, you know, he's done it in Spain, he's done it in Germany. A lot of the English hacks were thinking he can't hack it in the Premier League. Following season, signs Ederson, 100 points. Then the following season, after that, 98 points. And... now all he's missing is the Champions League.
Team of the decade, in my opinion. I saw them live against Arsenal and I've never seen a team like it.
They're the best Premier League team ever, I would say, last season's team. Because their brilliance was so consistent that it became mundane. And you can't get better than that.
Yeah.
They didn't get perfection, but they nearly achieved it.
You couldn't talk about City winning a game because it was just...
This gradual fall was inevitable. Like, it has, what goes up comes down eventually. And I do firmly believe Pep will be gone this summer. I think this is his last season at City. Because he's spent. This is what he does.
Yeah, it's intense. Yeah. I'd say it's intense to work under him. Like in this studio. Nice and relaxed. We let time beat us and that's pretty much our lot. So that's all we've got time for. Obviously, you can watch or listen back to any of today's show on OTB Sports Radio or on the Go Loud app or across our various social channels.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.